Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Torkum Talk. Super excited for today's guest. It's Matthias Giroux, aka Super Frenchy. This guy is a professional skier and base jumper. If you've ever seen a video that's been on the internet of a guy that skiing off of a mountain and all of a sudden an avalanche is coming after him and he pulls a chute and he turns back and there's the avalanche just flying over this hill towards him. Yeah, that's Matthias. He even has a show on Outside Network, and we end up going in depth on like life and business and the similarities of all the things you have to overcome when it comes to fear, when it comes to base jumping and bringing it into the business world, bringing that into your life and how to harness those kind of pressures for good. And no, you don't have to be a base jumper in order to harness those kind of things. We all end up having different areas of fear, different things that we're not comfortable with. So we go very deep on a lot of different things that I think you guys will get a lot from. So please enjoy this conversation with Super Frenchy and myself. Great to have you in here, but a lot of people know you as Super Frenchy. So I'm curious, as well as listeners, is where did that name come from?
It's a funny story, actually. I just moved to the States. I was going to school in Colorado, a place called Durango. And I was skiing in the local ski area, Durango Mountain Resort, also known as Purgatory.
Purgatory,
yeah. So I was skiing in Purgatory.
Okay.
It was amazing. So Super Frenchy was born in Purgatory.
So we got a good crew going on here. Gonna spend a fortune on heli time, but you know what? It's worth it. You have one life. Live your dream and go broke. So that's the way to go. Let's do it. Have a good time. See you guys at the bottom.
So yeah, Purgatory, they had put on a little bigger contest, and I was doing a little bit of everything at the time, you know, some big mountain skiing and some park skiing, and I entered the comp just not really expecting anything, and when I showed up, you know, I did a couple tricks and things went well, and all of a sudden things just started clicking, you know, and there was this dude that was there with a French flag, and he tied it around my neck, and it looked like a cape, and I was like, well, I got a cape with a French flag, like, I look like a superhero. I get to do a Superman front flip over the crowd. So I just dropped in. Did a big old, like, 40-foot, like, laid-out front flip. Over the crowd, turned around, stomped it, skied out of it. And then I grabbed the rope on the snowmobile to get back up to the top for another run. I still had the cape. To the top, getting ready for my run. And then the announcer goes, and here comes number 73, Super Frenchy. And the crowd goes loud. And I'm like, wow, that's awesome. So I dropped in, did another Superman front flip. Everybody lost it, and then the name stuck.
So, like, when that is there video of that?
There's no video of that, actually.
Oh, man, that's a bummer. That we'll just really take your word for it. But so what we know that you are, like, the first person to do many things, a lot of different base jumping. When it comes to base jumping, for those of you who don't know, that's the art of jumping off a very tall cliff and pulling a parachute right before you're going to die. Pretty much. The window of survival is not very big when it comes to base jumping, from my understanding.
Yeah, okay.
That's why it's the most dangerous, like, sport there is when it comes to
extreme sports. It is. You don't have much time.
I'm not saying you're going to die. I'm just saying it is dangerous.
I mean, you could be. I've accepted it. You know, I've come to terms with my mortality.
Right.
So should you.
Right.
You'll live much better once you do.
Right. So we're all going to die. So how do you push yourself to be the first? And are there any rituals you do before it? Or?
So, I mean, be the guy to do first. It starts with more than just practical stuff. It's almost like it's an existential quest, right? Mm-hmm. It's an intellectual and emotional journey that you want to immerse yourself in. But I don't always do a thing just because it's a first. A lot of the time, they also happen to be a first. For example, my first ski base jump ever was off Mount Hood in Oregon, and he ended up being the first ski base jump off Mount Hood ever.
So we're off Mount Hood, off the summit?
Straight off Mississippi Head in Zigzag Canyon. And that went all over the news. That really propelled my career. That was really cool. And then, but what started with this is, it started because I was inspired by the mountain. Mm-hmm. And that's how a lot of firsts that I do are...
By the mountain, you mean Mount Hood?
Mount Hood or wherever I travel. You know, okay. I've done some firsts in Iceland, some firsts in the Alps, some firsts in Chile. I mean, mm-hmm. I've done firsts all over the world. And every time it's not like, hey, let's try to do a first in this country. It's generally, you know, I see a picture of a mountain or I travel there and I see a cool feature. And there's not many people doing a lot of ski-based jumping like me. So mm-hmm. you end up being the first guy for a lot of stuff mm-hmm. when you're in the pioneering phase of a sport, right? I'm
sure.
kind of like the third generation of ski base jumpers, but they weren't that many before, so
yeah.
there's still a lot of firsts to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just kind of happen. As far as the process is, the ritual, I guess, obviously it starts by being inspired by a place to do it and then elaborating a plan. Then measuring the height of the object you're going to jump off, then how do you get there, establishing a route of approach, then making sure you you can analyze the weather pattern and work with locals on that too. Locals always know way better.
It's like making sure you have a vision.
Yeah.
Like exactly. You just don't go out there whim it. You're like, okay, this is how this is going to look. This is how I'm going to land this. And that comes into play like a lot in business as well. It's just like, if you're just going to go out and be like, I'm going to create this thing and I don't know what I'm going to grow it to. And I don't know what's going on, but I just think I'm going to make money. You're going to be up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. But fuck, man, you go and look at something like, I'm going to jump off that, but you just don't go, I'm going to jump off of it. You just said you calculate everything.
Yeah. I always say, and that applies to business 100%. One of my mottos is success is in the vision and survival is in the details. That's
okay.
how you get it done.
Right.
There's no other way to get it done.
But how much of the vision incorporates details? Like when you're looking at like, how about this? Is there a big guy that you're looking to jump off of that you haven't done yet that's in the back of your mind right now that just kind of haunts you besides the one that we're gonna get
besides
to the Alps
one.
Yeah,
I have a list of probably 5 or 6 big firsts that I'm trying to do, and the main thing is keeping it in mind, right? And I think when you really want to do a project, I'm not a hippie, but I do think that There's something such as the alignment of your conscious and your subconscious. When you really want something...
I'm not a hippie either, but I believe
bad.
In that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, I don't know, I didn't know you had like a quartz, like, rock.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
No,
so you're not a hippie?
No, I'm not a hippie, but I mean...
I'll buy you a dream catcher for Christmas.
Well, yeah, give me a dream catcher. I'm the guy who claims he's not a hippie, but he meditates every day,
right,
so, you know,
go
figure.
I cheat, that's why I base jump. You know? When you have to... What the level you reach with meditating, it takes you 2 hours,
uh-huh.
or I don't know, an hour, I do it like half a second, like just jumping off a cliff. It's amazing, but... But yeah, so I think it's when you really want something.
It's a good meditation
bad.
Habit.
Yeah.
I like that.
You
sit around for 2 hours. I got it done in 5 seconds.
man, you know, it's time is money. I'm on a mission here. I don't have time to lose. I'm gonna jump off a cliff. There's
no. Yeah, exactly. And then all of a sudden, boom! You're in sublimity, or not? You're in. Where'd you learn how to ski? Or what was when you were out in Denver?
In the Alps. I learned to ski in a place called Saint-Gervais, which is right in front of Mont Blanc, the highest peak
mm-hmm.
in Europe, about 30 minutes from Chamonix. Chamonix is the famous place there. So it's that little pocket between Switzerland and Italy.
And when you were skiing, was it like, okay, I'm totally going to ski off of big cliffs one day?
No, man. I was terrified of it. I was just skiing.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the ski instructors at the time were the authority, and none of them were doing this crazy stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw a couple of guys do backflips here and there, and for me, that looked completely unattainable. But then eventually, as I built my skills and paid my dues, that's the thing, paying your dues. It's so important to...
What do you mean by that?
Well, spending the time to train, ski, spend time on skis, get
mm-hmm.
some mileage, you know, and build your physical skills, build your mind, you know, learn to
be
react
patient
and adapt. And I'm not a patient person, but that's why also I say always immerse yourself in the process.
Mm-hmm.
If you immerse yourself in the process, you're going to enjoy the process. Therefore, you're going to do it well, and you're going to be very thorough about it. And as you're building your skills, you know, your foundations are going to be solid. And so... You should never be, if you're a skier or a base jumper, or maybe a business guy, be to a point where you're going to take this decision or this step forward, but it feels like it's so big that it's you're biting more than you can chew. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be in that position. You still want to be slightly intimidated and anxious, because that's what's going to keep you on your toes. You want to be scared. Fear is your best friend, right?
Right.
But you don't want to be mindlessly jumping into something like, oh, I'm just going to do it, because it's not going to work. And for example, skiing, every season, when I get back on skis, I start from scratch. I ski with my boots completely unbuckled for 2 weeks, just get my balance right, really get the feel for, you know, making my turns, being responsive, getting my legs to work, and then do some little jumps, and then bigger jumps, and then maybe do some grabs or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't go up on skis and start doing backflips the first day of the season. I've done that before.
What happened?
Well, I almost blew my knee. You know, mm-hmm. You don't do that stuff. You know,
right.
You just, I mean, some people do, and that's cool. That works for them. Maybe they spent all summer on a trampoline.
Well, if they're self-aware to know that they can do it, then exactly. They can. But, you know, you almost blow out your knee, and then you're done for the rest of the season.
Yeah, exactly.
But what point is it, like, are you doing too much preparation? Because I run into, like, colleagues and friends who are just like, oh, you know, the project I'm looking to do or the business I'm looking around to, it's just not right there. It's just not right yet. It's just not there. It's not perfect enough. I was like, and in my mind, I'm like, it's never going to be perfect enough.
Absolutely. That's
right. You just need to go and fucking do it.
Yeah.
But I'm not going there and being like, what? You know nothing about food manufacturing? Go ahead and start to move food manufacturing company and put all your savings behind it right now. I'd be like, do some research, but where's that line?
Well, I think it's... Like, people know that. Like,
yeah.
I think it's overthinking is the prevents so many people from making it happen, right?
Yeah. And I guess if we put it as a percentage of like you're 100% confident to like 90, like is there like a brush way of in between 80 and 90% or 90 to 100 when you're like, okay, I'm willing to jump off this cliff. I'll never be 100%. Because if it was 100% safe, then it wouldn't be as fun. You wouldn't get like your heart beating, like you were telling me before when we were meeting.
It's interesting. I try to find an equilibrium, right?
Uh-huh.
And so you don't want to be so excited that have so much fear that it's overpowering everything else, right? But you don't want to be too excited and too confident, because then fear is not doing its thing, and then you're gonna be. You know, you're going to crash and burn because you don't see things coming. You got to find the right balance between your fear and your confidence.
So that's what it is. That's just a balance you got to know.
It's the equilibrium. And that just comes from
meditation.
From experience. Meditation, exactly. Namaste.
Let's talk about the Alps.
Yeah.
So that was a big, gnarly crash for you. How long ago was that?
It was almost 6 years ago. It was March 27th, 2013.
And so what happened?
So there's this mountain in the Alps called the Pointe d'Arreux. And the Pointe d'Arreux was skied for the first time in 2006 by a buddy, Pierre Tardivelle. He's a legendary guide in the Alps. He's done over 80 first descents in the Alps and the Himalayas. For a long time, he was the highest skier on Everest. So the fact that he didn't ski this mountain until 2006, that nobody has skied it, means that it's pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
And... so I talked to Pierre about it, elaborated around.
Wait, so you said nobody skied it since 2006?
Nobody skied it until 2006.
Oh, wow.
2006 was the first descent of this thing, which, you know, skiing in the Alps, my home resort is over 100 years old, to give you an idea. I mean, people have been skiing the Alps forever.
Yeah.
The fact that nobody touched that mountain until 2006 means that it's a challenge, right?
Right.
And
Does that mean that nobody also base jumped off of it?
Oh, nobody had base jumped off
of it. So you're taking it to the next level.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
as you do.
I use my parachute as a tool to ski things that I couldn't ski otherwise, or ski them in a way that couldn't be skied otherwise. When
mm-hmm.
Pierre skied that mountain, skied the first, 1,500 feet, and then had to do two rappels, barely good between some rocks, and eventually got to the bottom of the valley. And then I guess I do more like direct descents, right? When
mm-hmm.
I ski the whole mountain, and then when there's the cliff at the end, I just jump off and then fly away, right?
It's just that easy.
So, yeah, exactly. That's what it is. And when I told Pierre about it, he's like, oh my God, this is perfect. This mountain is awesome for it. And I think a couple of the guys had looked at it, but they never tried. And it's, I attempted it in January 2013, got
right.
to the summit. The avalanche danger was too high, so
okay.
I turned around. I don't ever hesitate to say no.
Should you, especially if avalanche.
Yeah, early in my career, I heard somebody say it takes a strong man to say no, and I never forgot it. I took it to heart because we are all in this situation. We're just like, hey, fuck it, let's do it. You know, when you're in the fuck it mode, it's generally not a good idea.
You ever, you know, saying no is so powerful too, because the one thing that we're so tied to, like, we don't let anybody come to harm our property or our businesses. But when it comes to our time, we're so easy to say yes to things. Like, people are like, I'll help with that. But that's the one thing that we don't get any more of. You can't buy more time. You just have the amount you're allotted. Yet we give it away all the time. So what you're saying is powerful. Say no. Yeah, it's fucking powerful. Because if you are able to be like, no, I need to do this for this. Or no, I need to make sure I live to see another day. Whatever the case is.
Yeah.
You're totally empowering yourself to be able to put your energy towards what needs to be done. In your case, that could be living another day.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of my big concepts too for jumping is... You gotta jump it. You have to really live intentionally, right?
Yeah.
And living intentionally is the first step towards accepting risk. And so if you don't accept the situation, why are you gonna say yes? You know. It's BS.
Yeah.
And it's you betraying yourself, and most likely you're gonna betray others too. You know, stay true to yourself. It's all about, you know, being authentic and genuine and making it happen. That's the only way you can do stuff, right? Think for everything. You know, and but anyway, we can talk about that later. Maybe
I like this. So you're going. So we're at the Alps, it's all right. So we're at the Alps, and here's this thing that nobody's ski base jumped off of. So here comes Super Frenchy. The first time you go to it, there's avalanche danger. So now it's the second time we're there. Is that about right?
Yeah. Well, the very first time, actually, I my buddy's a helicopter pilot, so I went up and flew and scouted the whole face, looked at it from the sky, right? I did my homework.
Right.
You know, pay your dues. And do your homework. So I, you know, scouted with helicopter. Then I found the rod, the point I was going to jump off, looked at it all, measured it with satellite images and everything.
Nice.
Then I go back and...
What, LiDAR?
No, I just use Google Earth.
Google Earth, okay.
Like a fairly good, you know, estimate.
It does,
you know?
Yeah.
But then for the precise stuff, you go with a helicopter, you look at it. I was hovering maybe 10 feet above the cliff so I could see all the stuff.
Sure.
Look at my line. And the pilot is also a base jumper and skier, so he knows what I... And he's done a few base jumps, so he kind of knows how to scout things. Then, so 2013, January didn't work out. Turned around, skied another route. Then I came back in March. There was a good window. In the forecast, flew to the Alps, took 5 hours to climb up there. I started at 3 a.m, got to the summit at 8 or 9 a.m.
So when you're doing the summit, I love mountaineering, that's my jam. So are you, is this a, I'm not sure with this mountain at all. I'm assuming it's technical.
It's not super technical. But
so crampons needed or no?
Yeah, crampons.
Oh,
yeah.
Crampons, ice axe, rope?
No, even you need the rope a lot of time, you can.
Yeah.
If you trust your crampons.
That's still the extra weight then. Yeah, so are you jumping off? When you do jump off, you have the crampons in your pack and ice axe?
So generally I have, if I do a project like that, I don't, you know, locals know better. Even though I'm from there, I always hire a guide. And I'm buddies, you know, I have several buddies that I went to school with that I know.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the time they're going to ski another route down so I can.
They're not taking your route down?
Yeah. So, no, they don't want to jump off. So I can give them some of my equipment.
That's good.
And
it makes you lighter when you're jumping off. Yeah.
It's going to ski flat, like paraglide behind me or whatever. They have more room so I can put, like, you know, extra poles or crampons or whatever in there, you know.
So now you're up on the summit in March?
Yeah. And it was, you know, we had a couple. I knew the weather was going to change around noon-ish. And I had jumped a cliff across the valley with my wingsuit before, and I knew that you don't want to jump past 10 o'clock because that's when the weather starts changing.
Okay.
So I knew the weather was really going to change at noon, so I gave myself some margin. Okay, let's not jump past 10. With the summit at 8:39, that gives us an hour. Let's do it. There were a couple gusts of wind here and there, but some big lulls in between. So I timed it. It's like, okay, cool. I have time to ski the whole thing and jump up. And then we waited for the helicopter to show up to get the shot, and had to wait 15 minutes, and then the helicopter's there, dropped in, and right when I skied, I was about two-thirds of the way down, the wind picked up, but I couldn't feel it, because I was skiing, you know, generating your own
speed.
But my buddies could see it from the top, like the snow that was picked up by my skis was being blown straight to the side, and they're like, oh, isn't that good? But they couldn't say anything. It's not like I'm skiing with an earpiece, you know, like, you're going.
Are you
going
to ski with an earpiece when you do it again?
Yeah, maybe not, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah,
maybe you should.
I don't know. I mean, when you're going, you're going. That's the whole. That's why before we jump, we always say 3, 2, 1, see ya. The purpose of the countdown is to not turn back. It's like you're already going. This is the point of no return.
Yeah.
You're committed. You're going all the way.
There is no stopping your skis.
There's no stopping. And the thing, the way I made the mistake is to go up there too tight of a weather window.
Mm-hmm.
That was my mistake.
Okay.
And we had a couple signs with the bird, with the way the birds were flying by the cliff. You could tell there was a thermal picking up.
Yeah.
It was still acceptable when I looked at it, but when I skied down, that wasn't acceptable anymore.
So
when I jumped off,
yeah,
that's it was a crosswind, so I mean my parachute bit into the wind when it opened,
right.
But I was moving forward, so it twisted my lines, and there was a rock spire here, and so then the wind is like an eddy, you know, it's like an
so
eddy.
So it was a rock spire to your right.
Rock spire to the right and rock spire to the left, actually. It was between two rock spires.
And so
wide.
Which way was the crosswind coming from?
From the skier's right to skier's left.
Skier's right,
skier's
left. Okay.
So it creates like an eddy as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it hits, it's
right.
A big old burble, but you can't see it. It's not like an eddy in the river.
No.
You can see the current going.
No, you don't see the wind current.
So the wind made my parachute open this way, and then the burble in the back pushed me into the rocks. So I slammed into the rock spire. I hit it four times. Yeah, I don't know if it knocked me out or if I was still alert. Then,
did you think for a second this is it? Like after the first or second time being hit?
I still don't remember it. So
really?
Yeah. So I hit four times. I just saw that from the images in the helicopter, so I knew what happened. And we found the camera I had on my ski tip, so I could see.
Do you remember hitting it at all?
No, I remember. I don't know if it's me imagining hitting it or if it's actually flashbacks of it. I do remember making my last few turns because there was a section where I had to sneak between some rocks. It was kind of tight. I remember picking up some speed, jumping off, and then I don't remember anything until I woke up in the hospital 3 days later. So yeah, I hit the cliff four times, broke my femur, either knocked me out right then or after, but then my parachute turned around, which it's either I was able to turn it around or the line twist maybe pulled on one side more than the other, but I think actually reflecting back, maybe I put some input, but I don't remember it. Then I probably passed out under canopy. I flew 4,000 feet all the way into the valley floor, crashed into a tree, fell another 80 feet.
Were you unconscious during the 4,000 feet?
Yeah,
descent?
Yeah, I was
yeah.
out. It was like
okay.
a 4-minute flight, just in and out of the cloud, like a puppet on strings. And then I crashed into, 60 or 70 or 80 foot trees, I don't know. So I fell another at least 50 feet onto dirt, broke my femur again. And then the French firefighters were there in 5 minutes because they were just down the road. And then they called a helicopter. They picked me up in 20 minutes.
Were they down the road because they knew you were going to jump?
No, they just have the their station is
okay.
there. And the helicopter pilot could give the coordinates right away, so they were right there.
Nice.
And actually, a couple of the firefighters hit me up on social media. I was like, yeah, next time you're in town, let's go grab a beer. I was like, awesome. I was like,
I'll
be around.
Yeah, one or two.
And I woke up in the hospital 3 days later with double fracture in my femur, my left femur. I had 3 days in a coma. Not induced, just from the crash, and double brain hemorrhage in the front and the back right here, and then that's about it. A little loss of dexterity in my hand. But.
So that's pretty fucked up, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's pretty messed up.
Yeah. So you jumped off this thing, it fucked you up good, and now you're gonna go do it again.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
That's all right. Tell. Okay. So what I'm curious on is, how are you getting your mind right to do it again?
Well, when I woke up in the hospital, and first of all, too, it was that was 3 weeks before the birth of my son. It was my last project. My plan was to finish my season, you know, like a rock star, come home and be super dad for 5 months. And then you know, I got all messed up, so I came back and then came home. And when I woke up in the hospital, first thing is like, I need to go home. My son is about to be born. But then my buddy interviewed right there in the hospital, and he was like, hey, are you going to do it again? I was like, yeah. And then I came back to the States, you know, my son was born, and then you're battling your internal demons, like trying to become the person you were before.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have this new identity of a father, and then, you know, it's putting stress in your relationship too, but then you're trying to get back out there to be able to go jump off stuff again, right? It's still my job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love, and that's what I want to do. And and also, when you're a father and you almost die, but you survive, you're not really accepting your immortality again. So that whole process of learning to accept, you know, that one day you have an expiration date. And
what goes through your head when you're taking those risks nowadays, like you said, as being a dad?
I'm fully embracing it.
Yeah.
It's I'm you know, we're talking about living intentionally. I'm leading by example.
Mm-hmm.
I can't be a hypocrite, first of all. I can't tell my son, like, well, I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing because I'm a dad now. It's like, no, man. Like, I'm going to show you what it's like to live fully.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when I'm home, I'm there 100%. I take him skateboarding, we go skiing, we have a great relationship. I love my son. He's already fluent in French, too. Like, Yeah, I mean, he has mastered the skill of punk humor. It's amazing. And so we have this great relationship. But the second I leave home, the second I get in the taxi to go to the airport, that's it. I'm just focusing on what I have to do. And that's what, you know, high, like, elite military teams do, like, whether Navy SEALs or Army Rangers, when they go out in conflict, they're fully in it. Otherwise, it's going to take away from their ability to perform. It's the same thing in business, man. You can't go at work, you know, trying to close some deals and make shit happen and think about, you know, the stuff that is at home, you know?
Yeah.
You have to immerse yourself in everything. Again, immerse yourself in the process. Immerse yourself in the process when you're at home. Immerse yourself in the process when you go jump off a cliff. Immerse yourself in the process when you start a company.
So now that you are a father and your kid, I've already seen, so there's like footage of you giving him the half pipe, and so I know he's like following your footsteps and everything. And how do you see him when it comes to skiing? And has he asked you about ski base jumping? Has he shown signs in wanting to do that? What are your thoughts on that? Whether he did or didn't, how are your thoughts on him doing that?
Well, first of all, I'm not forcing anything on him. He's obviously influenced by his surrounding. You know, like Slayer is one of his favorite bands, and
weird.
Skateboarding, loves skiing, so
yeah.
He likes the Misfits too. I let him gravitate towards whatever he is gravitating towards, but then I support it 100% if he's really into it. You know, if my kid wanted to be a ballet dancer, I don't care. I'll support it 100%.
Sure.
He picked up a skateboard. He picked up my skateboard when he was 18 months old.
Yeah.
And he started playing with it. I'm like, oh, cool. That's interesting. And then at 4, he was like, hey, I want to go to a skateboard school. I'm like, perfect. And we have an amazing skateboard academy here in town.
Uh-huh.
Bering Skateboard Academy. So I put him there. And then now he's 5 and a half and he's dropping into 6-foot half pipes and bowls and carving walls and doing airs and stuff. And the other day, like, he did a Bertelmann, which is when you slide with your board, like, and do a pivot pretty much while dropping on a quarter pipe. I've never seen anybody do that. So he's already starting to build his creativity and confidence through a sport. That's amazing.
Yeah.
The base jumping thing, I've lost a lot of friends, you know, I almost died. I don't necessarily want my son to do it, but if he wants to, I will teach him. My wife
has... Does he have an understanding of you and doing it?
Yeah, he knows it's dangerous, you know.
Does he know that his dad does it?
Yeah, oh yeah, for
okay.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, he'd be 3 and I'd be packing my parachute in the living room, and then
sure.
I'd come home and he wants to watch the videos and all this stuff.
I'm not saying he shouldn't, I'm just curious.
He loves that stuff. My wife doesn't want him to do base jump, so right now he's still like, okay, I want base jump, and but he's already like,
has he said he wants a base jump?
Yeah.
There's nothing you can stop, dude. Like, if you were to stop him, first of all, you can't. Right?
Well,
at some age, like, he's just going to do it.
Yeah, you know,
so might as well teach him how to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if he wants to base jump, I will teach him. Or if I'm not jumping by then anymore, I will have to approve of who's teaching him how to jump.
Yeah, that, and you can always be like, you could be watching him pack his shoe.
Oh,
you can be like, okay, this is the next one you're looking to do. Have you calculated this? Like, all the stuff you were talking about before, the risk.
Sure.
Like,
yeah, I know I can mentor him in the process, because
yeah.
I've survived some jumps that, you know, that other people have survived or had some close calls. Like, I know I was the only one in the world to have like close calls of that type, you know? And so I know I can teach him valuable things. And if I can't teach him everything, if he wants to specialize in other stuff, I know who can mentor him in that. But yeah, we were in the car the other day and he's like, hey, mommy doesn't want me to base jump, but I really want to base jump. And I was like, well, you know, it's she's gonna be really mad if you do that. And he's like, yeah, but it's my life. And I'm like, well, you're making a point. And so that's between him and his mom. But if they come to an agreement or whatever situation, or if he really wants to do it, then I'll do everything I can to keep him safe and help him be successful.
Yeah.
That's all we can do as parents, right?
Yeah.
So,
so also when talking about mentors, like you being a mentor, your son, who have you looked up to as mentors in the past, still today, to make you? Who's helped make Super Frenchie?
Well, first thing was, I think, probably hearing the stories from my dad. My dad was had to do his military service. He was born in 1939, and I was growing up around his war stories, and aviation was booming, you know, after the First World War. And so he could name everything from a Messerschmitt to a Spitfire. He knew every plane in there. My my grandpa used to work at the airport in Paris early. My sister became an engineer in aeronautics. She was a certified pilot at 15 years old. And so we're definitely a family inclined to doing aerial stuff. And I had my first jump on skis when I was 4, and I would hear my dad's stories from when he was in the 9th Shock Commando paratrooper unit in France. He did about 100 jumps. He would tell me about his jumps in the military, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, wow, this is crazy. And I was always, I don't know, obsessed with parachutes since I was a kid, you know. And I saw my first base jumping images when I was 9. And
is that when you wanted to do it?
Basically, yeah. I mean, when I saw nine? That, it was a whole movie with extreme skiing, and by the day, extreme skiing, you know, steep skiing and snowboarding and base jumping and all that stuff. And it was like the typical cheesy 90s flick, but
sure.
It left a mark on me. Because I think, looking back on it, I remember being 9, and it was the first time that I saw grown men that were, aside from, you know, war stories or whatever, but grown men dedicating themselves to their passion and accepting to pay the ultimate price in order to experience the ultimate. And that was so powerful for me that it became the definition of being a man.
Mm-hmm.
Indirectly, my dad, you know, didn't.
So in a way, a definition of becoming a man was jumping off a cliff.
Pretty much, yeah,
yeah.
To summarize it,
yeah.
That was it. And also growing up in the Alps, you know, it's the birthplace of modern mountaineering, all the gnarly mountain
sure.
sports are being pushed there. I grew up near Chamonix where, you know, on average, one person dies every 3 days. So you grew up in this environment that's super dangerous.
One person dies every 3 days?
On average, yeah.
Really?
Of any mountain activity. But it's because people go there to push it.
In the Alps?
One
every 3 days.
Right, near the Chamonix, the Mont Blanc area.
Oh,
that's
wow.
That's the deadliest mountain range in the world. But that's where I grew up skiing. So you always hear these stories. And it's not the fact that people are dying doing this. It's the fact that people are going there to push it, to try things, to perfect their skills, whether they're climbers, paragliders, base jumpers, skiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a place where it's still booming now.
Sure.
And I grew up around that, and I was so inspired by guys like Jean-Marc Boivin, you know, Bruno Govy, you know, Patrick Valençon, all these guys are doing the first gnarly stuff in the Alps, like skiing 60-degree stuff.
Wow.
It was so gnarly. And then when I moved to the States, obviously Shane McConkey became one of my heroes right away. He was
mm-hmm.
one of the first Red Bull athletes, one of the guys that really pushed ski base jumping. And he was inspired by Jean-René Guévalet, who's in... ski instructor in the Alps. He's a buddy. He was the first guy to ski base jump off the Eiger. So again, you know, it's the Alps. The Alps have this huge influence all over the world of mountain sports, right?
Yeah.
And then the American twist on it was definitely, you know, more like that cowboy attitude, a little crazy with Seth Morrison. It was more like a punk rocker, but doing double front flips of 150-foot cliffs.
And that was one of your mentors?
Not one of my mentors, one of my heroes I looked
okay.
up. But I met Shane.
Shane
was the
yeah.
first base jumper that I met, and he told me how to get into base jumping. And then Eric Rohner guided me as well. And then Jesse Hall is somebody I was competing with in big mountain competitions when I moved to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
He started base jumping, and then he taught me to base jump 11 years ago now. So I was very fortunate to have these amazing mentors.
And so as we've talked before, you're mentioning that some of them have died.
Yeah.
So what do you think about that? Like, here's what I see. Like, you have mentors that have taught you a lot about base jumping. And then from the three that we talked about before, two of them have died.
Yes.
And most people would be like, there's your sign. Super Frenchy, there's your sign, you should stop base jumping. Two of your three guys that taught you how to do it don't live anymore. I look at that and I say, fuck that. Like, 90% of businesses go out of business their first year in business, yet people keep on doing it. And in my opinion, death is just a transcendence. I'm not sure where it goes to, but if you're okay and self-aware and, like you said, living to your fullest, then that shouldn't really register too much on the mark, just making sure you're doing it right and living to your fullest. But don't be pushed back by, okay, this guy died, which means that I will one day, because that's not necessarily true. If most businesses go out of business, you can't just think, oh, well, then I'm going to go out of business. That's not true.
Well, one of the things that I've learned through losing mentors and friends and heroes,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Patrick Valençon, Bruno Govy, and Jean-Marc Boivin are all dead too.
Yeah.
And the thing is, first of all, your friends or your heroes didn't die for nothing. There's something to learn from their deaths. Obviously,
what are some of the big things you learned?
You don't do it like that, or
yeah.
look for this, look for
mm-hmm.
that, right? This is gonna, they're empowering you, they're giving you tools to survive through their paying the ultimate price.
Yeah.
But also, when you I was having this conversation with a friend who's a skydiver, and he lost a lot of friends over the years. And when you enter this stuff, you're signing a pact with yourself that you're going all out for what you love. But also, your goal is to be, you know you're gonna lose some friends, but I'm gonna be the last of the Mohicans. That's the plan.
Yeah.
That's my goal. You know, I'm not focusing.
So how are you going to make? What are some different things that you're going to be doing when you go and back to the Alps? When are you going back?
I'm going back. We're still figuring out the dates, but it's going to be, the window is pretty much early March through early April.
Okay, so 2019, it's happening sometime.
Yeah.
What are some things from 6 years ago to today that you've learned that you're going to be applying to your business plan, kind of quote unquote, on how you're going to be tackling this jump that did put you in a coma and bust your femur twice?
Yeah. Well, actually, the first thing is, I think I went into it with the wrong mindset.
And what mindset was that?
Tunnel vision. You know, I was so focused on my project. I wanted to get it done so bad. But also because I knew my son was going to be born. I'd
call it summit fever too. And you already got to the summit, but you know what I mean? A lot of people die from that.
Exactly, yeah. And it's also, if you're going to do something really dangerous or very daring, you got to fully accept any potential outcome of your actions.
Including you not being able to do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now I approach projects where there's a 50% chance I have to turn around, there's a 50% chance I'll be able to do it. It's just the way it is, right?
That's the way it should be.
And that's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
And the mountains decide. You're not the one in charge.
No.
The mountains decide. You know, you're going to start a business, like, well, you're not responsible for the economic climate.
No.
You know, like, you just adapt to it. Mm-hmm. Same thing in the mountains. So what I was trying to do is, it was very interesting because I was trying to do a very consequential ski-based jump while being conservative.
Okay.
And you can't do that.
Yeah.
When you're going to do something dangerous, you got to go balls to the wall. Mm-hmm. You got to go all the way. But so while I had tunnel vision, I was really focusing on the edge of the cliff where I was jumping off. I was kind of ignoring the variables around.
Did you yield your speed or?
I think. What do you mean?
Did you slow down?
So I should have maybe skied a little faster, but the conditions were difficult. But the thing is, on a practical level, I was focusing so much on the exit that I was kind of like ignoring the variables.
Like the wind from the snow
you
from the wind.
You want to be aware of the variables, but you don't want to focus on it. It's like you want to know that you're gonna ski between those two trees, but you don't want to look at the tree because you're gonna hit the tree, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't just look at the little thing because you can't ignore the environment around. So I think I was so focused on my goal, I was ignoring the environment around, while also trying to be ultra conservative because my son was about to be born.
Right.
And you can't do that.
Did that make you not like hit the jump as hard as you'd want to, or
no, I think,
or
it's,
not stop, or?
Well, I think first of all, it made me.
Let's put it this way. 3, 2, 1, go. 6 years ago, you're halfway down. You're now seeing everything. What do you do?
What I should have done is turn around ready when I was at the summit.
Okay. What were the signs that you would see now that you didn't see 6 years ago?
Those birds flying, I saw them. It was a red flag, but I saw it as a pink flag. That's the problem.
What were the birds doing?
The way they were flying. They were flying right by the cliff, and they were not flapping their wings.
They're gliding. Yeah.
And I had encountered these conditions before on other jumps.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, my speed's going to overpower that strength of the wind because the wind is not that strong yet. With the way they were flying, I could tell the wind going super fast. But that same wind increased. But it was a south wind, and the south wind is called the Föhn, and the Föhn is very unpredictable. It's a wind that comes all the way from the Sahara.
Yeah.
And makes everything unstable. And so last winter, actually, I was going to do it. There was a weather window, and I look at the forecast. It was the same forecast as when I crashed. It's looking good, but I was like, nah, I don't think I'm not gonna go. It's that south wind. It's gonna. And my friends are like, well, good thing you didn't come. It was just like 6 years ago, probably even worse. So, I think I became better at assessing my environment for that specific area,
mm-hmm.
and also know how to fine tune it mentally as well. And on the technical level, I can pack my parachute for a faster opening, and then I'm gonna have a slightly different jumping plan while probably I'm going to modify a couple things on my gear, you know, skiing with the different pairs of skis, stuff like that, so I can carry more speed, have a different trajectory. So just fine-tuning it, right?
Okay. Is there any specifics that you could think of from heroes or mentors, friends that have died that you're like, that's now a part of how you prep, your pre-jump preparation, so to speak, or how you calculate different things?
Yeah, well, when I was in the hospital, actually, my friend JT Holmes called to check on me. JT is a very accomplished ski base jumper. He was jumping with Shane McConkey. He was one of the guys that I was looking up to before getting into ski base jumping. He was one of the stunt guys on Transformer 3, flying wingsuits downtown Chicago. I mean, the guy is very accomplished in skiing, base jumping, speed flying, everything. And he said something that I was telling him about the birds. Because one of my friends would call, I was like, kind of delirious. He's like, look for the birds, man, the birds. They're there to get you. It was like straight out of Hitchcock, you know. And he was like, yeah, we have to use every sign that we, every tool we have at our fingertips, we have to use that to make an educated decision. And that's what I try to do now is,
so it's like not flying by the seat of your pants, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You want to immerse yourself in the situation, but you don't want to have a tunnel vision. You still want to kind of almost be in that state of omnipotence where you're doing it and you're very driven, but you still stay cool and you just look at the facts. The facts don't lie. It's the black or white. The problem is, and also at that time, is I was jumping more and more into that gray area. The problem is that when you're in a gray area, how do you know if it's light gray or if it's dark gray? It's never fully perfect, but you should try to really be pragmatic. So that's what I'm doing now.
So one thing I'm curious on is, I know that you have been hired by several companies, name brands, to do motivational speaking. And so companies bring you in and you're talking to tons of employees for these companies. And for what I know, you're making like analogies for base jumping and business and life. What are some of the things where you notice like the people in the audience are starting to like nod their heads? And for the podcast listeners, what are some of the businesses that you have spoken for?
So I've spoken to Nike, spoken to US Bank, a company called Drive Systems. They make software for Jeeps and Chryslers and stuff like that. So some of the speeches I've done were more like just entertainment stuff where you show images and you share your experience. Like I've done stuff with Google Site Guys. So I've had some really cool experiences. But a lot of the time it's either... Yeah, applying the methodology of base jumping or an environment with a lot of variables and applying that to the business world. Or some of the talks, even if it's a business, they have a company event, they want to be a little entertained, and they're focusing more on creativity and inspiration and stuff like that. So you have more inspiration and personal growth.
Well, it's huge in business.
Yeah, exactly. For sure. I mean, you can't...
Creativity and inspiration. Creativity is what creates businesses, really.
How do you spark it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
For them, they just want to see a guy who had like a weird vision and somehow made it come alive, right?
What was your weird vision?
Jumping, of course, with a parachute.
Which is what would make you a man.
Yeah, exactly.
The only way I'm going to be a man is if I jump off this cliff with a parachute.
You know, I went to business school and I remember in my senior semester... our teacher was like, he was giving us pointers for a resume and stuff like that, and so don't do things like, I want to be a base jumper someday, or whatever. And I was just like, well, this guy has no clue what I'm actually doing in my life. And I actually applied my business degree to my career a lot.
Yeah.
Know? And so yeah, and some of the talks are more, how do you approach risk? How do you deal with fear? Where it's a lot more practical. It's going to be depending on the government shutdown, but I might be giving a speech to the National Aerial Firefighting Academy. So it's the pilots that drop, you know, fire retardants or water on wildfires, right? That fly these big tankers.
Yeah.
And they want a whole thing on risk. So it's a lot more practical, you know.
Sure.
And there's going to be some very case studies on base jumping, you know, what went right, what went wrong, how can you improve this, but also there's a whole existential side of risk. How do you accept risk? It's an intellectual and emotional journey that you're applying to a practical goal. How do you make it all come together? So that's kind of the stuff that I generally talk about.
What was your what do you think is the most comical, funniest base jump you've ever done? That doesn't include you getting a coma into a coma and broke your femur twice.
That was funny. I don't know why I'm laughing.
If you can't laugh at yourself getting hurt, what can you laugh at?
I did a ski base jump in Norway in the Lingen Alps, so it's 400 miles past the Arctic Circle. You're almost in Lapland. It's way north. Over there, my buddy has a lodge, and they do what they call summit to sea. So they ski from the summit and ski all the way to the seashore, and then they hop, you know, in a boat and leave in. And I was like, well, I want to do a true summit to sea with a ski base jump in the middle. So we found this beautiful mound with a 100-meter cliff, about 340 feet mm-hmm. or so, and big couloir, and then the ocean. So I was like, okay, I'm going to ski base jump with that cliff, and I'm going to land in the water. And so I skied down with a wetsuit, a life vest under my parachute, and just to make it even funnier, I put on some scuba diving goggles. The problem is that they started fogging up, so I couldn't see where I was going. So luckily, I drew a big arrow in the snow because the cliff was kind of like a diving exit, so I drew an arrow to make sure I knew where to go. So I couldn't really see anything. I literally had my hand on my extractor to open my parachute. I was in the air. I was like, okay, time to pull. I'm going to pull something with the fog. And to make it even funnier, we put a rubber ducky on the water. So I tried to land on the rubber ducky, but I missed it by 3 feet. So uh-huh. then they made me jump naked off the boat in the Barents Sea. That was, you know, 5 degrees Celsius. And it was pretty funny.
And they made you jump. you jumped off this cliff. You didn't do it good enough, so you're jumping off naked into the Barents Sea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about you guys jump off the cliff?
Yeah. Wait, was fuck? This? Oh, they were gonna make me eat my own weight in codfish, you know? So like, okay, I'd rather jump in the sea. And but they told me, yeah, don't swim more than 2 minutes, because then you'll have hyperthermia. And even if you feel like you can't keep swimming, your body will seize up, and you'll just drown. So so yeah, it's pretty funny.
What do you think? What's been one of your favorite books that you? Let's put this. So what's your most gifted book or book you recommend the most?
Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. It's a book I read shortly after my sister passed away. My sister passed away when I was 18. She committed suicide. So how do you a young man, how do you wrap your head around that, right?
Yeah.
And then it was one of the books that was recommended to me by one of my mentors at the time, a business mentor. And that book just really helped me realize that I already had a vision for my life already. I already had a meaning. And as I think a lot of people already do, they just don't know they have it. And so I think this book really helped me reinforce my vision and, most importantly, commit to it.
Mm.
And because when I remember being at my sister's funeral, that's the day I made a pact for myself. I'm like, all right, cool. You're not going to be a worm anymore. You're going to grow from that. And you already have goals past all this suffering. And then when I read Viktor Frankl's book, he had a famous quote in there that was inspired by Nietzsche. And I said, he who has a why to live can bear with almost any how.
He who has a why to live can bear most any how?
So, yeah, exactly. So,
that sounds like something. Have you heard from the author Simon Sinek at all?
No, I don't.
He has a book called Start With Why, and it sounds like an elegant way of putting his book. It's much more American. But anyway, go on. That was beautiful.
No, so same thing. And through his book, obviously, so he was a German psychologist and neurologist who was Jewish and was sent to Auschwitz by the Nazis. And then he's in this concentration camp, and he's surviving the concentration camps. And he's like, why am I surviving when there's all these forces of nature around me that are falling left and right? And mm-hmm. he realized that he was surviving because he had a goal past all the suffering that he was going through. And my experience was, you know, not as horrible as the concentration camps, but still losing my sister, which was very significant.
Of course.
And reading that book a few months after her funeral, I was already, I think, unconsciously focusing, yeah, towards my goals past all this, right? And I'd blown my knee as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was physically working on my rehab, getting better, but also trying to overcome this emotional and mental struggle of losing my sister. But all that made me, what really gave me the strength to do that is because I had these ski dreams and goals and all that stuff. And Yeah, and that's when I committed to use my fear as a driving force to be able to reach my goals. And that book was incredibly impactful, for sure.
So that quote that you just said, is that one that you hear echo throughout your mind through your life?
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. I think about that
before quote jumping almost, or anything.
Oh, yeah. I think about that quote almost every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was one of the foundations for me to learn to live with intention.
Do you ever see yourself drifting away from that quote and then catching yourself being like, I need to come back to that? I personally, I'll drift away from like meditation or stoicism. Like I'll be like practicing every day and I'll be like, wait a minute, no, I'm falling outside of what I've been teaching myself, and I reel myself back in. Cause it's easy to do. We're human.
Yeah. I think, I'm super hyper focused mentally,
mm-hmm.
but just like anybody, I do have a, you know, potential to be lazy. And so I do remind myself sometimes, you know, move your butt, get up early this morning, go training and go skiing, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, so you kind of like, yeah, it forces me to get back on track. But mentally, I don't really, I'm like a lab, man. I'm always chasing that ball. You know, it's like, then I love when I get my rub, my tail rub. I wag my tail. The lab is my spirit animal for sure.
Yeah, I would love to see the lab base jump off of the Alps. That'd be great.
Well,
find one. Yeah, it. Right. You're right next to you and go off. Yeah, with me, I run into dealing with anger over the past year, and I used to be just go off on my business partner, on some of my team members, on friends, ex-wife who used to be my wife, who ended up leaving me actually. For like the anger, and so coming and realizing that through different like books and that quote that you were saying, it kind of echoes into my new philosophy on life as well. But when I realize that me getting angry and upset at anybody or anything doesn't make it go away.
Yeah.
And there's actually an example just here. You're sitting here, and you know Mitch was fucking up with getting the audio going. And the thing was I was just like, me getting mad or yelling at him is not going to make it work.
I could feel your frustration, actually.
I was containing it, and it was kind of a little bit, but I was just like, wait a minute. Everything's going to be fine. It's going to be a great podcast, and it has been. But me just being like, Mitch, what the fuck? It's just going to get him more anxiety. It's not going to make him all of a sudden make that microphone work.
It's true. I mean, it's I think in the end, it's...
It's not like he's not trying his fucking dick off to try to get it on anyway.
That's another thing that I do talk about with Bass Jumping that I think I've learned over the years is some people might disagree with me, but I do believe that every emotion serves a purpose. But then it's just how do you apply these emotions?
Yeah.
Do you use it for positive stuff or bad stuff? There's no good or bad emotions. They're just emotions. You're feeling a certain way because that's you responding to your environment. And so mm-hmm. you can adapt to it. But you know, you can use your anger to blow up on somebody, or you can use your anger actually as a way to move your ass and make shit happen.
Yeah, as a good example with the Mitch podcast thing, I was just like, you know, we have this extra time while Mitch is figuring this out. Let's go through the questions again and see some different areas. And I know that made this podcast even better. So just what you're saying, like you can use it. I could just destroy Mitch's day and nothing better can happen. And we didn't end up going through the podcast questions a little bit further. Or I'd be like, we'll take this opportunity to do a little more homework on how we're going to have a great conversation.
Yeah. And just condition yourself mentally by just, again, immersing yourself in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And I have that a lot in base jumps, man. When I do something super nerdy or kind of jump that I haven't done in a while. This summer I went to the UK to visit a friend, and we left his house at 8:30 at night, and we came back to his house at 7:30 in the morning. We jumped off everything we could find. It was awesome. And the last jump we did was at sunrise. We would go up this 1,000-foot radio tower. We sneaking through some barbed wire stuff, your parachutes, you're not protected, you're climbing on a ladder.
Oh, that's great.
Holding onto a bed for 1,000 feet, you have no rope. If you slip, you're done.
Yeah.
You're literally going to get like, it's like falling into a meat grinder because your body's going to hit like all this. And you're in the middle of it, you're like, what the hell am I doing? This is ridiculous. Like, And at the time, you feel like, okay, this is going to be the best jump of my life. I don't need to do this ever again. Why do I do this? This is so dumb. But that fear kicking in. I used to get really worked up by those emotional roller coasters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very explosive as a person. That's the Latin French guy in me, you know, like, you know, slam a door. I try to not get really worked up with that emotional roller coaster, at least in the base jumping environment or the mountain environment, because it's just your natural response. It's just your natural chemical response to a threatening situation. And so every time after that, it's like, okay, just focus on each step. So you just focus on grabbing each peg, climbing up the ladder, and then you just like kind of get that tunnel vision. Well, but also that residual fear that you have in there is really making you hyper aware of your environment, which is just
isn't
you.
It though?
It's great.
Yeah.
It's you being used, fine tuning your senses to better react under that threatening situation.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And then you just, you know, I remember I was climbing and then getting myself in the rhythm. You know, okay, cool, one step at a time. Okay, already halfway up the ladder. We've been climbing for 30 minutes. Okay, another 30 minutes to go. I'm almost there. You know, and then I get to the top and then to the platform and I'm getting my parachute ready. I'm going through my gear. The wind's looking good. And I'm just like, oh, man, I'm terrified. You know, and I look down and really tired from jumping all night too, so that just makes it even worse. And then all of a sudden, you know, getting ready to go, and it's time. You know, you geared up, and weather's looking good, and you gotta go. So I'm getting ready for that, but I still had to take time to find that equilibrium between my fear and my confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, right now the fear is a little too high and the confidence is a little too low, so I kind of had to like even it out a little bit.
Going back to the beginning.
And I remember I was there and I was telling my buddy, he's like, "Oh man, I'm feeling. I hadn't jumped a radio tower in 8 years, so you know, it felt like I was doing it for the first time again, right?"
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Oh man, I'm feeling this one. I'm really scared." And then my buddy said something I'll never forget. He's like, "Yeah, man, it gives me bones. He's like, that's what we do it for."
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's what we do it for. Then you know, you tell your friend you love him, and I remember climbing over the rail and be like, really like chilling and really trying to match my breathing and my heart rate and lower your muscle tension, and you can feel your blood flow increasing through your fingertips and just taking it all in. And all of a sudden, you get in that zen mode, like, ooh. And that's when I know that I'm ready. And just give the 3, 2, 1, see ya. And then all of a sudden, within a quarter of a second, you're in the air and you're like, oh my God, this is the best freaking thing ever. You just went from being like, I will never do this ever again in my life. This is so dumb. What am I doing? To being like, this is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing in my life. And you're just flying through the air. And you got the cables on the radio shutter. And open, you know, not super low, but kind of low. Definitely scared the birds out of the trees. And then landed and like, oh my God, that was so good. That was so good. And right there, that jump just told me everything, you know, and it's that happens repeatedly throughout base jumping, and it's almost like base jumping taught me how to live.
Yeah.
Because every time I get in the, you know, in the groove of things, and I'm home a little too long, and I'm just, you know, routine is starting to kill my soul, and I feel like it's a slow death happening. And my wife sometimes feels it. She's like, you need to go jump off a cliff right now. I was like, all right, cool. So wake up.
You need to go
jump off a cliff. And then I come home and, man, I'm cooking breakfast for the family. I'm on it. Let's watch The Goonies. I've got this. This is awesome. And base jumping really helps. It's a very extreme way to do it, but it really works for me. And I found this thing. And I just wish people could find their thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's maybe reading a book or watching a football game or just, I don't know, or doing sculpture or painting or whatever it is, or playing the guitar, or maybe it's playing tennis. Or I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe
my current thing is mountain biking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or writing, you know, having a journal, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Just find this thing that helps you refocus, energizes you.
Motivate.
And makes you accept your place in the world.
Yeah.
I really think that, at least from my experience, we become really fucking weird when we're frustrated.
Yeah, we do.
Find something that to not feel frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be way better for you. It'll be way better for others. And then, you know what? Like, help your kids do that early. That's what I'm trying to do with my kid. His coach is there to teach him the technical stuff on his skateboard. I'm there to help him train his mind. And that's, if people can focus on their passions, maybe, it's too optimistic and maybe it's a utopia, but if people can focus on their passions, the world would be a better place. There would be less kids shooting other kids in high schools.
I would agree.
Focus on positive stuff like that, you know? You know, make shit happen for yourself in a positive way. That's going to help everybody.
Yeah, find stuff that makes you not frustrated, I think, would be my biggest takeaway from what you're saying.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Find that thing that makes you just come to that Zen moment and do it more often and find a ritual in doing it.
Yeah.
So not only that can you enjoy your life, but others can enjoy you living your life.
Yeah. And if you have, you know, like, I listen to a lot of dark music, right? You know, I'm a very exuberant, colorful person, but, you know, we do counterbalance. I know I have a very dark side of it, too. Just know that you can drive as much strength as your happy emotions. You can drive as much strength as out of joy as you can out of pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. A friend, that's my next book is a Carl Jung book, but I heard a quote from him this summer through a friend, and it was, no tree, he said, can grow to heaven unless its roots reach down to hell. Use both of it, you know.
Yeah.
Learn to grow from the dark stuff, grow from the happy stuff. That's what makes you whole.
Mm-hmm.
Life is not just about being this happy little bubble, which is, you know,
no,
what
you
we
gotta,
see social media all the time.
Nah,
that's what bugs me too.
It's social media is just PR campaigns for everybody.
Exactly.
It's everybody's own personal PR campaign.
But it's becoming such a celebration of mediocrity, you know, and it's just like, no, man, like, just
or a celebration of people going to Europe and everything too.
That's
only the positive. It's rare that you see somebody going on social media and being like, fuck, I just got fired. I need help.
No, that's true. But there's ways to do that. Just, but bottom the line is be authentic. You know,
mm-hmm.
you see a freaking powerful movie that made you angry. I just watched Bomb City last night.
Okay.
About the punk kid that got killed by some jocks in Texas.
Okay.
Horrible story.
Okay.
You know, and because the kid is wearing army boots and, you know, leather jackets and chains, they're like, well, this kid was going out for a fight. It's like, no, they're just typecasting that kid. And that kid that killed him didn't spend a day in jail. That movie, you know what? It made me cry out of anger, but it felt good. And as a result, I posted some stuff on social media. I'd be like, wow, incredible movie.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for putting this stuff out there. The truth needs to be told. It doesn't mean that you'd be like, oh my God, I'm pissed off and this and that. No, just again, you know, grow from your dark stuff.
Sure.
And I think that's what there's going to be, we've been fed such, you know, cliche images that people are trying to just stuff down our throats. Let's just get real again.
Yeah.
People want you to be authentic, genuine, and real. That's it. And my way to be real is to jump off stuff. What's your way to be real?
That'd be a good social campaign right there.
Yeah.
Just for Super Frenchy, really. My way of being real is jumping off stuff. What's your way? And get people to think about that. Honestly, you should. You should start posting that stuff on Instagram.
Yes,
like,
yeah.
that we may have come to like a really good freaking cornerstone to like how you help
Thanks,
the world. Yeah. It's my way of being real. What's yours?
Yeah.
And you don't have to jump off a cliff. Let's not inspire people to jump off a cliff when they don't know how. Because like we were saying, it could be riding. It could be reading. It could be mountain biking. It could be like whatever. Like what brings you out of a funk? What makes you not aggravated? What makes you not frustrated? What makes you happy? That's some powerful shit, man.
Yeah, I'm not saying that social media is bad. Social media is not bad. It's just what people choose to communicate through that and how they do it that bugs me. I'm not gonna lie. And this way, I'm on my own path there, man.
Yeah.
And hopefully, if that can help people be real, cool, awesome. You know, that's I guess.
Well, speaking
that's
of
part of my mission
speaking of social media, how do people reach out and find you? Whether they're looking to book you to talk or for their business, or if they're just looking to get some advice on finding their thing that's going to make them unfrustrated, or they just want to see you jumping off cliffs.
So on Instagram, at Super Frenchy Official.
Okay.
Because I'm the only official super one. Facebook.com/ Super Frenchy Official.
Mm-hmm.
My Twitter is my real name, Anitya Giro. But if you wanna, book some speaking engagements, go on my website, superfrenchy.com, and there is a contact form, and you can fill out why you want me to come talk and give you a high five and get your team fired up.
And also, I've been seeing you more and more active on LinkedIn lately.
LinkedIn as well, sure. It's funny, LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn.
Yeah, LinkedIn's great.
It's so to talk about genuine and authentic.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, let's cut the crap. We're professionals here talking to each other. My job is to jump off stuff. So obviously I'm posting stuff about base jumping, but I'm drawing parallels to, it's fun because for me, it's like, I can draw parallels to the business world, see what people think about.
There are so many parallels in business. There's so many people that are too nervous to do their own thing when they know they have the idea and everything. They're just like, oh, I just don't know how to jump off the cliff, where they can end up getting a lot of inspiration from you.
Yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn. There was a post actually I did not too long ago.
Where are they finding it on LinkedIn? It's not super Frenchy.
It's Matthias Giroux. It's my full name, And but there's a post I did. It was a technical jump I did last summer, a low cliff. It was only 230 feet. With a weird end run, did a flip on it, had to fly over a whole river, land that little strip of grass between boulders, so super technical. And so I used that jump to break down the process and also reposted that jump to talk about being data oriented versus data informed. And because I was talking about that with a friend in the business world, how, you know, being data oriented versus data informed, how you just need to get some key pieces to make an educated decision, but still follow your gut instinct.
Right.
You know, it's we are totally forgetting to use our primitive intelligence. We have our modern intelligence, right?
Yeah.
But your real intelligence is combining the two, the modern man and the caveman inside of you, right? Because the caveman probably knows more about your environment, and the modern man probably knows more about making an educated, rational decision based on whatever you're dealing with, you know, at work or spreadsheets or whatever it is. And that's the thing with base jumping. Okay, sometimes, you know, you approach a jump and everything looks right, but you don't feel it. That's okay, man. Walk away. Trust your instincts. Even if everything looks good, but the fact that you have a negative feeling about this probably means that you shouldn't do it. And that sometimes the opposite happens. You're like, okay, the conditions are not perfect. We are in that gray area, but I feel really good about this. I've got this.
Yeah.
And then go and do it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I was talking about that with another.
You don't have lack of regret then. You don't have micro regrets or regrets at all if you end up going and doing it.
I never regretted saying no.
Yeah.
I've never regretted taking a chance when I knew I could put it off with with conditions that were not perfect. But I do have regrets from forcing myself to think I can do it. And generally, these jumps don't go well. You know, you land in a tree, or worse, you're in the hospital in a coma with a broken femur. You know, and that's so important. I was talking about that with a friend who was a ex F-16 pilot, and he was then an instructor for the, you know, fighter pilots that were joining the military and all that, the Air Force, and he said the worst students he had were the students that. We're trying to focus on every instrument in the cockpit. The cockpit has 350 instruments. You can't focus on it all.
No.
So, and you know, I said that the checklist enables you to fly instinctively. So, go through your checklist. You know it's good. Focus on your top three instruments so you don't have decision fatigue by trying to focus on too much stuff at the time. And so you can just focus on flying.
Mm-hmm.
Focus on flying. And that's the thing. And that's what I apply to base jumping. It's like I go through my checklist.
I apply that to business.
Exactly.
That's a lack of delegation.
Exactly.
It's like honestly, if you just go through your business and you have a bunch of team members that are willing to help you, but if you keep on thinking, if I don't do it, then it won't get done the way I want it to. And there's so many entrepreneurs that think that. They're just like, I have to do it or else it won't get done. If you don't delegate and if you don't empower your people, how are you going to scale? There's only one of you.
Yeah.
You're not cloning yourself. And by the way, you make mistakes all the time.
Yeah.
You just are okay with you doing it, but you're not okay with other people doing it. Grow up. Learn how other people can make mistakes too. Grow your business, grow your mind, anything like that. I'm sure you end up doing it too. When you have team, like you have the helicopter pilot helping you scope out the Alps, you were like, I'm going to fly to helicopter too. What?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, you fly the helicopter, I'm going to help look at stuff, and you know shit about this too, and we're going to make a good team, and then that's going to help me jump off this thing, and you're going to live it next time.
Exactly. And you know what? And even when you fuck up or your team members fuck up, sometimes it actually turns out to be an opportunity. It's kind of weird, you know, because it makes you become aware of something else or whatever, and then you do it differently, and or you create something you didn't even think in the first place, right?
You know,
that's how LSD was invented by the government, right? It was a mistake. I mean, I don't recommend drugs. I'm the most anti-drug person you... What is it, but like,
are you?
Yeah, I don't do drugs, man.
Oh, it's freaking surprised me of everything you're wearing right now, jumping off cliffs and everything.
Dude, that's the thing. That's the cliche of the extreme athlete. It's like, dude, this guy, you must be doing coke. I don't need to do drugs, man. I drink kombucha. I could jump off stuff. Like, okay, I like to drink beer. I don't even drink that much beer.
Yeah.
No. I don't. Do you imagine me on drugs?
No, I couldn't.
It'd be the worst mistake ever. I don't even drink coffee. Like, Dude, I would be headbutting the wall if I was drinking.
Well, at least you're self-aware to know that you shouldn't be doing hard drugs. Yeah, that's good.
Stay off drugs. Kid.
Yeah, stay off. Yeah. Well, man, I think we get up talking for hours, but I know you got to pick up your kid, yeah. And I want to be respectful of your time. But thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's
fun.
Been super fun. Let's do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to.
All right, awesome. Sweet.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you for watching Torkum Talk. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Please hit subscribe and/or follow to be notified when we launch our next episode. Have a good one.